This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
What's going on, everybody? This is Jay from Sub 70. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Today is Monday, April 9th. It is the Monday after the Masters. Patrick Reed won the green jacket yesterday. Some of the interesting storylines from the tournament. I would start out with the sort of disappointment stories. That would include, I think, Tiger, Phil, Dustin Johnson, Justin Rose, Bubba Watson, even Rory's Sunday finish kind of leaves a bad taste in your mouth. Some of those guys that everybody just thought were going to compete and show up and really put some pressure on. And, you know, while they played decently, none of them were really ever in the mix. So those were definitely disappointments, I would say. On the other end of it, yesterday you had huge pushes from Jordan Spieth and Ricky Fowler. And if you were watching the telecast, it was very, very evident that the Augusta crowds were definitely pulling for those two. Kind of an interesting dynamic, and there's been some stories that have come out today about that, about how people necessarily weren't cheering for Patrick Reed. And usually the Masters champion, as they are making their way around the back nine, you know, they're getting applause, they're getting cheered on. It's, you know, a situation that the fans are usually pretty appreciative of whoever that person is. And it was just one of those situations where people were definitely cheering for someone to pass Patrick Reed rather than having him win the jacket. So there's a really good story from Alan Shipnuck that came out today. You can check it out on our Twitter or Facebook page, basically detailing Patrick Reed's amateur career and his family situation. He's a very abrasive guy, very confident, almost like a golf robot, and he just wants to destroy anyone in his path. And it talks a lot about his sort of polarizing character and some of the weird situations that have developed over the last 10 or 15 years. He doesn't talk to either of his parents or his sister. He's basically just been assimilated into his wife's family. And it's definitely a must read. It's a very interesting story. It's not the Jordan Spieth, you know, Justin Thomas, Smiley Kaufman story. This interview is with Jimmy Stanger. Jimmy is currently on the web.com tour, but he was an All-American player at University of Virginia. He was considered for every top college award there is, played incredibly well in college, was a All-American, as I noted, was the ACC Player of the Year. The conversation is really insightful about growing up being a golf fan, deciding that he wanted to play professional golf, going through college, having some ups and downs, and kind of, you know, second guessing whether he could make it as a professional golfer, and actually creating some backup plans in case that didn't work out. And then now where he's at as far as getting status, trying to play in events, what it's like showing up at a tournament, being an alternate and not knowing if or when you'll be able to play. And then also just going through a lot of the process that's not necessarily on the golf course, arranging your travel schedule, talking to and figuring out equipment or clothing, sponsorships and endorsements, picking your swing coach and your other coaches that will help you and be part of your team going forward. Jimmy has a ton of great perspective on this, and he is truly treating this as a business. And that's the way that he is sort of trying to establish himself and make sure that he has a solid foundation around him so that as he moves forward, he's prepared and ready to succeed on the web.com tour and eventually the PGA tour. He also has some really sort of hilarious stories about playing in some of the web events. He did play with Julio Bell. And if you're not familiar with the story, just Google Julio Bell Golf. He played in a web event and shot, I believe, 96 and then 104 or something in that ballpark. So he discussed that as well as the situation where you get, you know, a Tony Romo or a Steph Curry playing in the event and how he feels about that, especially when those spots could be going to someone like him. So really great talk. Jimmy obviously taking this very seriously. He's planning it out. He is definitely organized and, you know, trying to be as successful as he possibly can in golf. We'll definitely be rooting for him. Keep an eye out for him on the web.com tour and some other PGA events. Hopefully he can get some exemptions. Check him out on Twitter. Here is the interview.
I'd like to welcome to the podcast former All-American at UVA, web.com tour player, Jimmy Stanger. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, for our listeners out there, we had a conversation yesterday, and my software system proceeded not to work. So, Jimmy, I appreciate you doing this 2 days in a row, and you're a brave soul for having to be with me for 2 days straight. But thanks for coming on. First question, did you get to watching the Masters today, and thoughts on it, and who's your guy for the week that you're picking to potentially win?
Yes, I have had a chance to watch some of the Masters. I'm actually watching the Masters right now, so I get to enjoy that. My Masters week always consists of me sitting on the couch on Thursday during the hours of the Masters going on and watching it as long as I can. One of my favorite weeks of the year. I love Rory winning this year. I think he is playing some great golf. I think he's making a lot of putts, and there's no pressure on him this year with Tiger back and all of the old guys looking like they're supposed to contend. So I think Rory's going to sneak in and win his Grand Slam.
Well, it's going to be a great weekend of golf. There's no question about it. One of my favorite weeks of the year as well. Speaking of golf, how did you start playing golf? Who introduced you to the game, and how did that come about?
Yeah, so my dad introduced me to the game when I was about 3 or 4 years old, right when we moved into my childhood home. It was right on the golf course, so he would bring me out pretty much every weekend when he was home from traveling on business. I wanted to spend time with my dad growing up, and I loved sports, so my dad naturally got me into the game of golf with him and his buddies. He taught me well, and lo and behold, it turned into an awesome career.
And at what age did golf sort of become the number one sport in your life? I know you probably, like all kids, played other sports, but at what point did golf sort of take over as being your number one?
Yeah, so I played pretty much every sport possible growing up. It really became my main focus and goal once I got into high school. I knew that golf was going to be my career and the thing that I could do to get myself a good scholarship in college, in addition to perhaps making it out on the PGA Tour with all, you know, the Jordan Spieths and Tiger Woods of the world. So it was really in high school that I stopped playing other sports and moved into focusing solely on golf.
And then I also read when you were a kid, you got to go out to the Valspar, be inside the rope, see some of the tour players. What kind of inspiration did that give you? And is there any good stories of being around those tour guys, you know, and sort of dreaming about being out there at this, you know, and playing an event like that, and lo and behold, you're out there. It's got to be a cool feeling of playing in that PGA Tour event and then starting off there kind of seeing it from the inside as a kid.
Yeah, being able to play in the Valspar the past 2 years have been, you know, dreams come true for me, and dreams that I could not have imagined coming true. Growing up, I worked the range for I don't know how many years separating golf balls because professional golfers like their Pro V1s versus Pro V1Xs in their practice sessions, things along those lines. It's amazing for me now to be out there on the range hitting golf balls next to, I mean, this last year, Tiger Woods and Sergio and Rory and Jordan Spieth. To see them all out there and to be playing and competing against them is an unbelievable dream come true. As far as growing up on working the Valspar and seeing all these professional golfers out there, I was a standard bearer a few times, and I saw how players could really make an impact in my life as a kid. Just a simple hello or, you know, high five or thank you very much would make my day. And it's pretty awesome to be in that position where I can make a kid's day, you know, just by going over there and saying thank you for the hard work that they're putting in. So I really appreciate that from them, and it's a dream come true for me to be able to do that for someone else.
That's cool. let's talk about you being on the web.com this year, and it's a pretty great accomplishment for you to get through all three stages of Q school right after college and be able to play one of the major tours in the world. So first off, congratulations on that. It's not easy. It's tough. And my question is, obviously you've got game, you've got through the three stages, you're out there competing, but what have you had to work on golf game wise once you got out there and sort of saw what that competition is at this point, and what are you kind of doing to get better, as all golfers, you know, want to improve?
So since I got out on the web.com tour, a lot of my mentors, including Dr. Bob Rotella at UVA, has really encouraged me to play down the moment. So while it's an unbelievable experience, and again, I am so blessed to be playing on the web.com tour so early in my career, working my way to the PGA Tour, I'm really just trying to treat it like any other golf tournament that I'm playing in, and as an amateur in college. I was lucky enough to play at a top 10 Division I golf school at the University of Virginia and play against the best of competition that I could possibly have played against as an amateur. And to be honest, the web.com has some unbelievable players, but the winning scores and to be able to contend is not that different, in my opinion. Sure, there's 150 players versus 86 players, but I really believe that my Division I experience and consistency performing at college has helped me out tremendously on the web.com tour. As far as getting better, I think I need to get a little more patient. I would say the biggest reason you see web.com tour players shooting 20 under par at golf tournaments is just because they're more patient and they don't make as many mistakes. You would hardly ever see bogey-free rounds in college. You see them all the time out there on the web.com tour. Their short games are very strong. And if they hit the ball out of position, they don't panic. They get it back in play. And worst comes to worst, they make a bogey. They don't exasperate the situation by any means.
In talking about not having the moment get too big or overwhelming, or, I'm sure you don't get overwhelmed because you're a professional golfer, but I'm trying to say, like, when you're going through Q school, is that a pressure like you've never felt before, or because you've done this before, you are, you know, a top level golfer, you just take it one shot at a time and you get through stage one and you get through stage two? Or does that pressure ramp up as you're going through Q school, kind of out there basically playing for your privileges of what tour you're playing on?
It's certainly a different experience than anything a top amateur would experience. Typically, as a top amateur, we're exempt for most of our events. We know what we're going to be playing in. And Q school is, quite frankly, a very expensive hit or miss. Either you make it through and you're going to make a lot of money because of the, you know, $6,000 you put down to get into Q school, or you're going to try it again 1 year later. So there is a lot of pressure involved. You really have to emphasize the one shot at a time. You have to emphasize the fact that you're good enough to get through as long as you play your average game. That's the biggest key, especially at first and second stage of Q school. You really just want to go out there and take one shot at a time, keep the ball in play, and you know that there will be birdie putts that fall. You know that you don't have to go out there and win. You just have to top 20, and then you can move on. As far as the pressure being different from college, I can tell you I felt a lot of pressure in the ACC championship and winning that this past year. A lot of pressure in, you know, helping the team get to the national championship my junior year and senior year, as well as trying to perform at the national championship. There's a lot of pressures at whatever level you play in professional golf. It's a little different on the pro level, but I don't think it's something that, you know, we're not trained to handle. I love it.
I've been following you on Twitter, and then on some of the tournaments you've been first or second, alternate in. How tough are those weeks when you still have to prepare like you're going to be in the tournament, because there's a good chance you will get one of those spots, but you're sort of at the mercy of when that tee time is going to be or how it comes about? So how are you handling those weeks, and how's that process been?
There's certainly an art to handling being the first or second alternate in a golf tournament. You have to go through all your preparations. You have to, you know, show up on Monday and Tuesday and do your practice rounds, do your studying of the golf course. And to be honest, when you don't get in a golf tournament, it is a bit demoralizing. It does take a lot of energy out of you. At the same time, you want to be very careful not to wear yourself out. A great example for me was in Panama. I learned I was first alternate on Tuesday morning, so I quickly booked a flight from Orlando, Florida, down to Panama City, Panama. And by the time I got there, basically my bags were lost by the airline. It took a while. Long story short, I was at the airport at midnight, had to be at the golf course at 5:30 a.m. for the very first tee time. So I'm there. I did a ton of preparation for the golf course as much as I could, whether that was through Google Maps or walking the course on Wednesday without my clubs. And I showed up to the course early and probably did the one thing that doomed me when I later got in the tournament. As I warmed up, I was ready to go, and I stayed practicing for about 6-7 hours straight until I learned 6 minutes before my tee time that, hey, you're out there on the golf course. So there's an art to the, you know, equation of you don't want to wear yourself out, but you want to be ready to go. Unfortunately, this last week in Savannah on the web.com tour, it was the same thing. I was the first alternate, went there and did my practice round on Tuesday, did my practice round on Wednesday, and then Thursday morning showed up at 5:30 for that first tee time, was prepared and ready to go. And unfortunately, even though I felt like I was rested and ready to go whenever they called me, it didn't work out as I ended up the first person out of the tournament. So there's definitely an art to being the first alternate to being the last person in the tournament, but it's something as well that comes with the job, and it's just another great story that I'm going to be able to look back on with fond memories.
And the same, I'm assuming, goes for Monday qualifying. So then on top of everything else, if you're not fully in that week, I assume you're Monday qualifying for spots as well during that week, correct?
That is correct. The first four events on the web.com tour did not have Monday qualifiers, but the past three have.
And then also the web has been giving out some interesting exemptions over the years. They've given one to Tony Romo and Steph Curry, who are both really good players, but they're not professional golfers. So how do you feel about those that you're out there playing for a living? And it's a double-edged sword because it brings attention to the tournament, but it takes away a legit spot, for lack of a better word, for a touring professional. Could be somebody like yourself. So how do you kind of view their system of those exemptions, and what's sort of your thoughts on it?
It's a good question. And I think there's definitely a yin and yang to the equation. In a full field event on the web.com tour, there's 156 players playing in the event. So in my mind, the tour exemption has 5 to 6 exemptions they can give out. If I'm not one of the top 150 players in the golf tournament already, you know, who am I to complain about being the first or second man out of the sponsor's exemption? At the same time, I truly believe the sponsor's exemption spots need to be given to someone who's going to help bring publicity to the golf tournament. So I love the fact that they can give it to Steph Curry or Tony Romo, in that they're good golfers. They can still hold their own, and they're still very respectful. And I think there's other situations that get a little tougher. You know, I got to play with Julio Bell down in Colombia, and he did not play as well. He shot in the 90s and 100s. That might be a little different of a scenario. But at the same time, I think it's important that, you know, I am personally fine as a pro if they give it to a Steph Curry, someone who's going to come out and beat and not finish in last place in the tournament. At the same time, I would love to be receiving those exemptions because I fully believe in 1 or 2 years down the line, I'm going to be looking back as a top player in the world saying, thank you so much. How can I help out with the tournament? So there's a yin and the yang to it. You want to give it to young players who are going to be potential future stars. At the same time, you want to make sure that you bring publicity to the tournament, because publicity equals money, and money is going to help everyone else out in the tournament.
But in the same token, you're playing with a guy who's, for lack of a better word, 50 over par. I assume it kind of throws off your rhythm. Obviously, you know fairly quickly this person's not a professional golfer. Was that a tough situation? And it's not his fault he got the exemption he's in, but is it a tough situation to deal with when you're kind of watching a guy shoot 90 where you're used to watching a bad round of somebody shooting 77, who you still can tell has the talent and who has enough game? That had to be a kind of a surreal situation to find yourself in.
Yeah, it was certainly a bit different. Fortunately, I was paired with another great professional golfer in Jim Neuse, and Jim and I had some fun just cheering for the guy, hoping that he would make some more pars and potentially start turning it around. It's something where you have to, you know, take the lemons and make lemonade. It hurts you a bit. It probably costs you a few strokes, but there's nothing we could do about it. It's similar to playing at your home club on a Saturday morning with, you know, your local member. He's an awesome guy and, you know, great person, but necessarily won't be shooting in the 70s anytime soon. So that's where it was a learning experience for me. And I think it was a learning experience for everyone involved. And hopefully in the future, we'll be able to, you know, golf courses and golf tournaments will be a little bit better at finding the people they give sponsors exemption spots to.
Well, at least you'll have a good story for it as well. I mean, you can always say you're the guy who shot 95-95 in a professional event. I doubt there's a whole lot of other touring professionals who have that one to take to the story of something crazy like that. So
absolutely,
it's an interesting one. The other, when I said I was going to interview you, I asked people on Twitter, and I had some good buddies of mine. Bear with me here. I turned my phone off. We'll just edit this out.
No problem.
I'll start over. When I said I was going to be fortunate enough to interview you on the podcast, I, you know, put some questions out there. What would be interesting for you guys for me to ask Jimmy? And we got a lot of feedback of what is it like for a touring pro, you know, to start off their career. So I have a few questions next. They'll just sort of be of how that process actually starts and that transition to being a touring professional. So my first question on that is, you know, when do agents, and this is just a generic question, it's not for you specifically, it's just more of a generalities when I'm asking this, is when do agents start making the relationship or the contact with really good college players like you were, knowing you guys are going to take that next step, and how does that process sort of work from that from that introduction to essentially signing with a firm that can kind of be a team member, you know, to help your career along?
Yeah, that's a good question, and something that I know a lot of junior golfers and top amateurs who are looking to turn professional don't know the answer to that. In my experience, I want to be careful here. I don't want to violate any rules or get anyone in trouble. But in my experience, agents start reaching out to you after your big moment in amateur golf. So for me, that was after winning the Southern Amateur between my junior and senior year of school. It was a bit later than a lot of people, but not necessarily late in the sense of it was too late to get anything done. I know a lot of other players, for instance, a good friend of mine, Doc Redman at Clemson, just a freshman last year and a sophomore this year at Clemson. After he won the U.S. Amateur, I'm pretty darn certain he received quite a few calls and emails from agents just asking him when he's going to be turning professional, when he's ready to go. It really just depends on the player. If you're an amateur golfer or a college golfer looking to play professional golf, the agent's problem really is one of the last things I would worry about. They'll reach out to you after you do something special. And whether that's, you know, winning a big golf tournament in college, just being a top college player year in, year out, or even going and playing professional golf and, you know, winning a bunch of mini tour events or getting through Q school, agents will find you and they'll contact you. Just keep working on your game. Again, they're very respectful and very kind about it, and they just start with developing that relationship when you really start standing out and proving that you could become the next Jordan Spieth or potentially become one of the next top 50 players in the world.
Same scenario, but when do the club companies start coming to the young and up-and-coming players? And then as a tour player, I know the ball is such a huge deal. Like when Rory was looking at his equipment deal, he kind of went to the TaylorMade ball first and kind of worked the contract around that. So do you do the same thing where the ball is your number one priority and then work at the equipment around which ball you're going to play? Or how does that whole process work for you to sort of say, I'm going to use this equipment on tour this year?
I certainly think the golf ball is the most important factor in deciding what club you're going to play. For me, I had always played the Pro V1 golf ball, so it was something where, you know, Titleist had a big leg up just because I didn't want to switch golf ball. In terms of coming out of college as a top amateur and turning professional as a young gun, most of the companies will want you to switch into everything. So that's golf ball as well as all clubs and bag. So it's something where if you haven't played the Callaway golf ball before, it can be a little bit of a risk. Now, a lot of players can make that risk or make that change and do it just fine. I'm not trying to call anyone out there, but it's difficult for sure. And the golf ball could be wonderful. If it's different than what you're used to, it could affect your game. The golf ball is very important. If you're not signing a contract coming out of school, a lot of club companies will still help you out, whether that's giving you discounts or sending you free equipment on clubs. And in that case, you're pretty much free to play whatever you want. The club companies want to help you out, and again, they want you to play well, so they're more than willing to give you whatever equipment they need, and they're more than willing to hear your advice and opinion. So I've had a great experience with the club companies that I've had. I play Titleist clubs at this moment, and that really originated from the golf ball. I didn't play Titleist clubs in college. I played TaylorMade and it just didn't work out turning professional that I would be able to stay with TaylorMade. So I slowly started making that transition to Titleist. I was fortunate enough to sign my hat deal with Nike. So I wear all my apparel Nike head to toe, which is every kid's dream. But, you know, that necessarily means that I get to play whatever bag I want. So it's a wonderful experience for me. I'm in the best of situations. I get to play whatever clubs I want. Hopefully it ends up working out to be a deal with Titleist or some other equipment manufacturing company that comes in. But it's something where whatever your major deal is, your hat deal is, that's what you're going to want to stick with and play.
So that was my next question, was the apparel deal. Was there a multiple of companies that you had to pick from, or were you always comfortable with the Nike equipment and that's the brand you wanted to be associated with? How did that come about as well?
Nike's in a unique situation since they got out of the club business. They really are focused fully on apparel, which means if I sign a deal with them, I can play whatever I want. One thing I probably should clarify is that the most valuable thing on a golfer is his hat, at least from my experience. So whoever you sign your deal with your hat, whether that's, you see a lot of players with Shirks on, you see a lot of players with TaylorMade, Titleist, et cetera, the hat is what the club companies and the apparel companies want. So I was fortunate to go with Nike, which really gives me a lot of leeway to work into whatever clubs I want. I love Nike. And again, I don't think there would be a kid out there who isn't lying who would tell you that he doesn't like Nike, but I've been very fortunate to sign a deal with them.
How is getting used to just traveling? Are you traveling, obviously when you go out of the country, it's by plane, but if the tournaments are, you know, fairly close to you, are you driving, are you flying? And then who helps you with the logistics of just getting through your week between hotel bookings, flights, everything, you know, that you, so you're not doing it, so you're freed up to play the best golf you can. How does that process sort of work?
That's another great question. There's a lot of logistics that go into this game outside of just playing golf. That's where I really view my opportunity to play professional golf as a bit of an entrepreneurial activity. I'm investing in myself. I am my own business. And fortunately, I have a team around me that's really helping me out with that. My agents, as well as my parents, and they really help out a lot with booking hotels, as well as rental cars and flights when I need it. It's also a lot of driving on my own, I've realized. I drove up to Louisiana, 12-hour drive, drove over to Savannah, another 12-hour drive from Louisiana. So it's a lot of time in the car, a lot of audiobooks, a lot of music, a lot of time to learn. But it's definitely something where there's more that goes into golf than meets the eye. You have to have your body ready to go when traveling. That's very difficult. I'm sure as anyone knows, when you sit in an airplane or sit in a car for a long period of time, your back doesn't want to turn and swing 120 miles an hour with the driver. So you have to really have a team around you that's going to help you perform your best and keep your mind off of things that are not related to playing your best.
And my next question kind of flows into that. So everyone has a team around them anymore. So how do you go through that process of selecting a swing coach, a mental coach to kind of help in that aspect, and then a physical fitness instructor or coach to kind of keep your body at you know, peak performance all the time? How does that process come about as you're turning professional to make sure you have that team around you?
That's another good question. I was very, very blessed growing up to have the same swing coach in Gary Anderson of Schematic Golf up in Orlando since I was about 8 years old. So I'm still working with him. I actually worked with him this morning out on the golf course. We have a great relationship such that I can just send videos to him and he can help put everything together. My mom is a bit of everything. She's my nutritionalist, a bit of a mental coach, and a bit of an agent when she wants to be as well. But my mom and dad are very influential in my game as well. I know my fitness coach, I've really started working with him over the past 6 months. Diesel Fitness, they work with a bunch of baseball and golf players, as well as Dr. Bob Rotella, one of the best sports psychologists in the country. I had the blessing of working with him through my UVA connection. Since he lives up in Charlottesville at UVA, we would often go and meet with him twice a semester, as well as be able to have his phone call and talk with him whenever we need to. So I have an awesome team around me, whether that's my fitness coach, mental coach, my family, as well as my swing coach. And I'm hoping to add soon a caddy to that mix. So there's a team, just like Jordan Spieth says, you know, we are out there competing and we are working. Everybody has a very important role. I'm looking forward to that team becoming stronger and leading to some awesome results, hopefully this week in the future, week of the Masters.
Well, this is fascinating. I still have a few more questions on this, you know, process as, you know, becoming a professional. And one of my next ones was going to bring up, you know, having a full-time caddy. So essentially, how does that process work of finding someone who really will add to what you're doing, someone who's a true professional? I know you said you haven't had a full-time caddy yet, but what attributes or what are you sort of looking for in that position when you finally fill it and kind of help you, you know, on the golf course as well with having that person, you know, there with a bunch of experience that could kind of add to the team?
Yeah, a caddy's very important. It's not possibly the most important. He's a bit of everything. He's your nutritionalist out there. He's your mental coach, a bit of your swing coach when you need him to be, as well as a friend and hopefully personal mentor. So I'm looking for all of those things in my caddy, which is a lot to ask. So in that process I'm going through, I understand I'm probably going to have to train a guy. We're going to have to grow together. I hope to have a guy in the bag for a long period of time. I think you've seen the most successful players in the world, guys who win major championships and compete in major championships year in, year out. They don't switch caddies on a whim. So I'm really being patient and trying to figure out who I want to invest in, you know, someone who can be on the bag. In my mind, I would say the number one thing that I want in a caddy is someone who is enjoyable to be around, who has a positive attitude every day. I think that's the most important thing, because when you're out there on the golf course grinding, you want someone who can make a joke, who can have some fun, and who you genuinely enjoy being with. A lot of the caddy skills they can learn and pick up. At the same time, it would be nice to have someone who's had some experience and who's seen the best at work, so they can impart some of that information to me and be a little bit of a mentor. So there's a lot of things that go into finding a caddy. I'm still searching through that process now to hopefully settle on the right person.
And another interesting question I had forwarded to me, and I think this is kind of, it's fascinating to me, because everybody, you guys all work out. And then the question was, and I didn't think about this much, is what's the difference in workout intensity, say, in an off week versus a week when you're playing a tournament?
So an off week like this week, for me, it's a lot more lifting, it's a lot more strength building. You're being very careful. Again, you want to have good form. You don't want to become too bulky, so there's still quite a bit of mobility exercises and stretching. But it's more of a, I don't mind being sore tomorrow morning. Come golf tournament time, it's a lot more focused on mobility. So you sit 12 hours in a car. I hear a lot of announcers saying all the time, oh, he works out too much. Well, quite frankly, if I don't spend 30 minutes in the gym after sitting for 12 hours in the car, I'm going to hurt myself. So I need to go there and reawaken, as Tiger likes to say, I need to activate my glutes. I need to get in there and make sure my back is limber. I need to really understand what's going on with my body, so when I swing a driver 120 miles an hour, I'm not going to tear something, and I'll be able to do that week in, week out for the entire year. So it's really important that during golf tournaments and during tournament weeks, you're doing recovery exercises, you're doing mobility exercises, and then during off tournament weeks, you take advantage to get some lifts in and maintain the muscle.
Trying to find a home course for you once you turn professional to have the practice facilities, the style of golf course that a player of your level needs. So how does that process come about where you're finding a home club that you can play out of that is up to the standard that you kind of need at that point?
I think finding a home club is one of the more important things that you could do as well, being a young pro. In a sense, that's your office. That's your home base. I was, again, lucky enough to grow up at a course called Avila Golf and Country Club in Tampa, and we have some awesome professionals running out of here. I mean, we have three or four guys on the web and PGA Tour that practice out here, as well as world-class facilities, and I've been practicing here since I was 6 years old. So I don't need to move. I'm going to stay here and practice here for hopefully a long time. But I think those world-class facilities and having that ability to have a home base that has excellent greens and has a good short game and range is very important.
When you play with the other guys at your home course from the web, is it usually a practice round, or do you guys like to have a competitive game to keep you sharp? Which direction do you guys normally go with that?
At home, it's always competitive, 100% of the time. On the road, typically, there'll be some sort of competition in there, whether that's a birdie game, if we haven't seen the golf course, or if we're out there and we've seen the course, we'll do something a little more competitive. Again, it's all light and all competition-based. But we're having fun out there, and I think we all like to compete. That's why we're professional athletes.
So you've been out on the professional circuit now, and you're getting your career started. What's the biggest surprise, and it could be anything, that you've sort of found out or learned as you've been playing on the web.com tour? Is there anything that comes to mind that you didn't think about and, wow, that's interesting, or I didn't expect that?
I would say the biggest thing that surprised me a bit, and it's less of a surprise, it's more of an observation. It's how particular professional golfers are with their routines, how particular they are with their playing partners, their caddies, the equipment that they use. You know, professionals are professionals for a reason. This is our job. This is our living. So we want to make sure that, you know, our caddy is doing the right thing. We want to make sure that our other player doesn't walk in our through line past the hole. We want to make sure that, you know, we're keeping up with the group in front of us and that our playing partners are doing that as well, and making sure that our equipment's working week in, week out. So just that idea of being very specific in your taste out there on tour is something that I didn't see in amateur golf as much, and something that's intrigued me in playing professional golf.
And there's also, you know, some real veterans out on the web.com, you know, some guys like Ken Duke or some guys in their late 40s who are going to try to get their game sharp for the Champions Tour. Have you been mentored by any of those guys? And how is the relationship between kind of the young guns out there versus these old guys? I shouldn't say old, they're my age, late 40s, mid 40s, who are established players. How does that dynamic sort of work between the generations per se?
There are some great people out there as well. I mean, I remember seeing Stuart Appleby at the past couple events, and I remember getting his golf ball signed for me when I was a kid and looking up to that. But yeah, there are some great players on the web. They're very kind, and they're very willing to take you under their wing a bit. I do think guys tend to hang out with their generational age group a little more. One of the good mentors of mine is Tyler Duncan. He's out there on the PGA Tour now, just earned his card through the web last year, but he's been very kind to me. Just to have someone that you can text stupid questions to and ask them, you know, all the rookie questions about being out on tour, it's unbelievably helpful, and it certainly made a difference. At the same time, I have a ton of friends who are my age who are playing out there on the web, and it's inspiring to see them playing well, to see Sam Burns play with Tiger and beat Tiger at the Honda and then win the web.com event last week. You know, that's someone that I compete with week in and week out, and I've done so since junior golf. So it's really inspiring to see both guys my age play well, and also to know that I can compete with, you know, savvy veterans from the PGA Tour like Stuart Appleby.
When you go to a web event and you have not seen the golf course before, how long does it take for you to be acclimated where you're pretty darn comfortable of where you can hit it, where you can't, and how you can attack the golf course? Is it one day you've kind of got it, or is by day two or three you're pretty comfortable, or how does that process work for you to be ready to go?
I'd say by Sunday night is when I'm fully comfortable with the golf course. There's always surprises that tend to jump up at you while you play courses. Hopefully you can take all those surprises out of play by keeping the ball in the fairway and hitting the ball to the middle of the green. But it always takes more than a year to get comfortable with the golf course. You see so many guys on the PGA Tour play better their sophomore year versus their freshman year for that reason. They know the golf course is better. They're more comfortable. At the same time, I'm very confident with my preparation plans that I learned from Bowen Sargent at UVA, just to look over Google Maps before you go play a golf course, to do a little extra research and ask guys who played the course the year before or multiple years, you know, what are some of the tricks to the golf course? And whether that's the greens breaking east or west, or, you know, certain fairways being firmer than others, there's definitely a learning curve that you have to pick up quickly being out there as a rookie on the web.com tour.
Well, I think we've covered the how you become a professional on the web.com tour. That's fascinating to me. And like I said, that was the biggest feedback I got from people of, if I was talking to you, of what questions they'd want asked. And last part we do, it's always sort of a lighter question. So I'm going to throw a few more at you and whatever kind of comes to your mind on this one. So we talked about that you played golf at UVA. How much fun was your college experience? What most did you get out of going to the to college and having that 4 years?
Oh boy, it was a bit of an up and down experience for me in college. My first 2 years, I did not play very well. And it really led me to thinking that professional golf might not be my career. And then my last 2 years of school, I really and tried to enjoy it more. And it was funny. The more I enjoyed golf, the better I played. So I would say that, especially the last 2 years of school, I'm going to look back with fond memories the rest of my life. And I just had so many great memories, so many great moments that I'll be looking back on and thanking God for a long time.
I also know when you were in school, I read you had a very cool internship at the Federal Reserve. How did that come about, and what was sort of the best part of that experience?
As part of that moment that I was telling you about, the first 2 years of college did not go as planned on the golf course. So I started exploring areas in my backup plan, which was the UVA Business School. And UVA Business School, the McIntyre School of Commerce, is a very good business school with a lot of contacts. So between, you know, my acceptance into that school, as well as some, you know, family contacts and friends that we knew who worked at the Federal Reserve, it turned out to be a perfect summer internship for me, a chance for me to really reset my golf career, to get away from the game for a couple months, as well as an opportunity for me to set up a great foundational point for my business career. I definitely learned during that time, though, that I don't want to be spending much time in the office if I can avoid it. I love being outside, and it was a great learning experience for many reasons, but it also taught me how much golf would be a blessing to be able to play as a professional.
And I know you got to have the honor of meeting Chairwoman Yellen. How was that experience to meet, you know, somebody in that position? Had to be pretty cool.
Oh, man. I mean, for me, I always grew up admiring all these professional athletes. To meet someone with that much power, who has that much control over really the U.S. economy, was pretty incredible. And it just, again, shows you that there's ways outside of sports, there's ways outside of golf to make an impact on this world. And I think it really showed me that golf isn't the be-all, end-all, and that there are some very smart people out there who aren't the most athletic.
You can pick a dream foursome. So if you could pick three guys off the PGA Tour to go play a fun competitive game with, which three guys are you picking to make your foursome, and what do you like most about those players?
I'd probably say Rory McIlroy. I love his golf swing. I love the way he hits the ball, and I think he'd be an awesome guy to play with in your blue tee game on Saturday. Luke Donald's always been my favorite player in the world. Love the way he goes about playing golf strategically. And he was the number one player in the world for a while being one of the shortest straight hitters on tour. I think that's unbelievably impressive. And then a good friend of mine on tour, Blaine Barber, who I think has some incredible character and is a very underrated PGA Tour player, very good player. So that would be my dream threesome.
You may have answered one of my questions, or one of the answers potentially for this one, but outside of golfers, because of the game of golf, so we'll take Chairwoman Yellen out of this, pretty cool person to meet, but who else have you met because of the game of golf that's been one of the coolest experiences you've ever had?
Well, I don't know if it's because of the game of golf, but I'm good friends with and a good mentor of mine is Tony Dungy. So to be able to meet someone of that character and that success in the sports world is pretty awesome for me. And then I would also say I'm good friends with Fred Ridley, the chairman at Augusta. And to be able to see him and see how he has progressed, and it's just to see that he was recently elected chairman at Augusta National is so cool for me. And I'm sure it's great for him as well. But I've been so lucky to have so many great mentors in my life. Those would probably be the two coolest people that I've met outside of golf.
Also, I know you played in the NCAAs at Rich Harvest Farms in Sugar Grove, Illinois. We're out in Sycamore, Illinois, so we're about 40 minutes away from there. Tough golf course. How do you think it held up to some of the best college players and how would you rate the golf course overall?
Tough golf course. It's gotten to me many times playing there. I think I played there three times throughout my college experience. It's always in impeccable shape. I know the national championship had a lot of play between the women the week before and then, you know, what is it, 30 golf teams there that week. I also know the rain, it was difficult. So the course is always in great shape. It's a very good layout. There are a few holes out there that are a bit funky that are I want to consider championship quality, but it's very close to being a championship quality golf course, and it is one of the best that I've played in college.
Best golf shot you've ever hit under tournament pressure? Could be in your college career, could be in your pro career.
Probably the bunker shot underrated shot, but the bunker shot that I hit from 50 yards out at regionals my junior year of school, or third year of school, as we say at UVA, I hit it from 50 yards to about 1 foot, and it got us through on the number to go to the national championship. One shot more, we would have had to go to a playoff, and it was the coolest experience celebrating with my family and team after that.
And you couldn't have a tougher shot, right? That's no man's land of
50-yard bunker shots are dead. They're not where you want to be.
I think that one would qualify. Lowest round of golf you've ever shot, tournament or non-tournament?
62. I did it in Hawaii, and then I did it for a college golf tournament a year and a half ago, and then I did it in Q School after shooting an 80 in the first round. Shot 80-62. So they come out of nowhere.
Averages out okay. Yeah.
Exactly. 250 rounds. Not bad.
Perfect. My last question for you. The best two or three golf courses you've ever played in your life, and what makes them and their architecture so great?
Well, I've had the blessing to play Augusta National. I did that last year in February, and I think that speaks for itself. It doesn't need any explaining. And that was a dream come true for me. I even have the golf course painted on my wall at home. I love the place, and the history behind it was incredible. I would say Bandon Dunes, specifically the Pacific course, Pacific Dunes. Just unbelievable golf course. The scenery, to be able to walk out on the third or fourth hole and see the Pacific Ocean with seals and whales in the water, you know, 200-foot drop to the beach below. And the day we were there, it was blowing about 50 miles an hour without a cloud in the sky. So it was absolutely perfect. It was one of the most stunning golf courses I've ever played, and also a great layout with the dunes and link style. And then I would say the third best course I've ever played would be Red Letters, a small private golf course that I've played up in Heber Valley, Utah, right next to Park City, Utah. I love that golf course. I think it's a great championship layout, very long golf course, a lot of undulation, but very fair as well.
When you got to play Augusta, you brought that up, did they let you play the champion tees or the pro tees to the back?
They did.
And was it everything you is it hard to play it because it feels like you're kind of walking through a museum and you want to see all, you know, put the ball at the places where all these famous shots were? Is it hard to focus on playing regular golf? I've had this, speaking for myself, like you go to Pebble Beach and you see some of these holes and you're playing golf, it almost feels like you're walking through a museum or something like that. Is that, do you get that same surreal experience at Augusta?
Yep, that's an awesome way to put it. You're walking through a museum, you're walking through holy ground. You're walking on holy ground, and it's tough to actually focus on your golf game the first time you play it. I know for me, I didn't actually play that well, but I enjoyed every single moment. I would consider the first tee shot at Augusta, you know, top two most nervous moments of my life. So just that experience of being able to play there, even in a non-tournament atmosphere, was absolutely incredible. I mean, there were so many holes where I was just asking my caddy, hey, did this guy hit this shot from here? Did Jordan Spieth make his? And they were not necessarily major shots. They were, you know, hey, is this where Jordan Spieth made birdie on the first hole in 2015 to take a 3-shot lead over Justin Rose? Or is this where Zach Johnson free-putted on hole 16? You know, things like that most people don't really remember. So my caddy was very kind in answering as many of those questions as he could. And then also to be able to obviously hit the famous shot behind hole 16 green that Tiger chipped in, and the chip that I think, was it Larry Mize made against Greg Norman in the playoff in hole 11?
Yeah, on 11.
But,
yep.
I mean, to be able to see all of those things out there and play the same holes and try to recreate those shots, that was something I'll never forget, something I'll always remember fondly.
Golf course easier than you thought it would be, or more difficult than you thought it would be?
Very, very difficult. One of the hardest golf courses I've ever played, and that was not in tournament condition. Unbelievably long golf course. I don't know if they need to lengthen it whatsoever.
Well, I certainly appreciate your time. We're going to be watching you on the web this season. And thank you for doing, like I said, number two interview with us with our technical problems. I certainly appreciate your time. And best of luck this year, and hopefully we'll get you back on for a quick 10-minute podcast when you get your first victory. I would love to be able to follow up with that.
Sounds good. Enjoyed talking to you again.